I think you're going to really like this one. But we're going to get down and dirty on part B. And I hope it doesn't... I think I'm presenting it in a way I never did before that I think will help clarify the issues enough so that you'll understand what we're trying to accomplish and why we're doing it, okay? So, let's get started. We want to pray first and foremost. Father in heaven, thank you for calling us together, for the beautiful Sabbath that we've had thus far. And in anticipation of this presentation and even men's ministry, we pray that your Spirit will lead and guide. We pray, Father in heaven, that you would teach us and help us to clearly see these issues so that we will know that your prophecy is sending a message that the world needs, and they do not understand it the way we do, and we must understand it so we can show them what the true meaning is. So blessed to this end, take charge of me, Lord, and make it plain to all of us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, now the first part you can look at for yourself. This is a review. And notice that we show the parallelism between the prophecies of Daniel 2, 7, and 8. The problem comes in part B of the review section. If you will notice, there are three schools of interpretation. Remember, we looked at this last week. And the titles or names of those schools of interpretation, by the way, there's probably a couple of others, but they truly are insignificant. These are the three major schools of interpretation. And notice they're called preterist, historicist, and futurist. And I want you to know that like Jesus and his disciples and the early reformers or all of the reformers, we are historicists. Preterism and futurism came in after the Counter-Reformation. Both of these schools, which contradict each other, came from Jesuit priests, very intelligent men. Their purpose was to get the Pope's neck out of the noose. You understand that? You see, the historicist understanding of prophecy clearly shows that the papacy is the Antichrist. And they were trying to find a way of getting the heat off the Pope. And they came up with these two alternatives. And now the rest of the world basically believes either one of the other two. But they don't believe historicists anymore, which was the Reformationists. We're all historicists, as well as Jesus' disciples. So I'm going to try to clarify these issues. I hope this sinks in. This preterism and futurism was introduced by Satan to block the real meaning of prophecy. In fact, notice the preterists right away. They come into conflict with Daniel 8. They say that the progression of the kingdoms are Babylon, Media, then Persia, then Greece, and then the little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, what's the problem there? Daniel 8 clearly says that the ram in Daniel 8 represents the kingdom of Media and Persia, combined, not separate. And the bear, over in Daniel chapter 7, represented the kingdom of Media and Persia, not separated. They had to separate those two in order to get Antiochus Epiphanes to fit in the history of the little horn. And I'm going to tell you who Antiochus Epiphanes is. This is where the line is drawn, folks, Antiochus Epiphanes. And the majority of commentators today believe that. The little horn is a man called Antiochus Epiphanes. And they say that all of Daniel was already fulfilled. It's already done with. Okay? The futurists, if you notice, follow us head for head until we get to the little horn. in which they say that Antichrist's little horn is in the future. Hasn't come yet. Do you see how both of these interpreting schools take the Pope's noose out of the neck? Do you see it? One says it's already happened, Antiochus Epiphanes. The other says hasn't come yet. And Historus has said he's been here for a while and is still going to be around until the very end. Here's where the problem is. So, look at D. First question. Why did I call it Daniel chapter 8, the cosmic conflict? Why? And before you answer that question, take a look at number 1 under D in your outline. First of all, it says, he, the little horn, magnified himself even to the prince of hosts. Daniel 8 is the battle between Christ and Satan. Daniel 8, as Daniel 7 was, shows us that Satan has a system that he inaugurated for the purpose of destroying Jesus and his ministry and the historicist's understanding of interpreting prophecy. That's why I call it cosmic conflict. That's what it is. Please remember, those two other schools of interpretation take the Pope's neck out of the noose, put one in the future, the other's already been done with. So you see, it can't be the Pope. And so we see that the work of the little horn was to fight against the prince of hosts. By the way, I don't know why I didn't capitalize that. Prince of hosts is supposed to be capitalized. How did he do it? The little horn took the daily away. Now, folks, you got to go over last week. We studied that. The daily is the ministry of Jesus Christ. The papal see in its system replaced Jesus' ministry in heaven. We went over that clearly last week. Number 2, it took the place of his sanctuary and cast it down. The little horn calls attention to the ministry of the priesthood. They now do the work on earth instead of pointing them to the work that Jesus is doing in heaven. And number C, a host was given to the little horn against the daily. The priest took over the ministry of Jesus on earth from him in heaven. And D, it cast the truth to the ground. Remember, we found out he changes times and laws. This is the cosmic conflict because this is a direct battle between truth and error, Satan and Christ, good and evil. And Daniel 8 is crucial, folks, because we clearly see the ministry of Christ is highlighted in Daniel 8. That's why Satan hates this chapter, and he's come up with two alternative interpretations so that we won't see that this is the ministry of Jesus that's being talked of here. Number 2, how long shall the vision concerning the daily take place? That is verse 13. And that's the angel asking the other angel, how long will this take place? And the angel says, I'm specifically talking about the transgression of desolation. And that again is in reference to the real system of worship being cast down for a false one that replaced it. Number F, to give both the sanctuary, there it's referring to the sanctuary again, and the host to be trodden underfoot. And the host here underfoot is God's host, God's people. The angel was so astounded in verse 13 that he asked the other angel to interpret this for him. I'm going to embellish this a little bit shortly. So what am I doing here? Why the cosmic conflict? Because it clearly see from these verses in Daniel 8, chapter 8 I mean, that this is a literal battle between Jesus and Satan. Satan has his appointed conspirators on this earth cooperating with him, whether they know it or not, in order to cast Christ, his ministry, his sanctuary, his truth, to the ground. And in the meantime, take out the real church members on top of it. That's why it's called cosmic conflict. That's why this chapter is so incredibly important. because it points specifically to Christ's ministry. Daniel 8 tells us where Jesus is, what he's doing. It even tells us why he hasn't come yet and what we should be doing. Because it turns us to the sanctuary service. And the sanctuary service tells that story. You see? So why cosmic conflict? Because this is the battle from the very beginning. We're seeing it played out clearly in Daniel 8. And so that's why this is so crucial. And that's why you can see that you have to understand a little bit about the alternative schools of interpretation, because you see now how they are working against the ministry of Jesus and blocking out what he's doing, where he is, the whole ball of wax, folks, and puts the attention here on earth. In fact, I love it because you don't understand, I haven't mentioned this yet, the preterists put it on Antiochus Epiphanes in the past. The futurists put it on Jerusalem and Israel in the future. And nothing is said about Jesus. So this is serious. It's casting the sanctuary to the ground. It's casting Christ's ministry to the ground. It's casting the truth to the ground. In the process, they'll take out whoever they can that oppose their way of thinking. And according to Revelation, we're going to find out that they get very physical about that. Okay? All right, now take a look at the parallelism between the little horn of Daniel 8 and the little horn of Daniel 9. I meant Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. Please correct that. I just noticed the mistake I made. The parallelism between the little horn of Daniel 7 and 8. Now, I'm doing this for a specific reason. I want you to go home and look at those verses for yourself, and you will see that the little horn here referred to in those two chapters are the same one, because remember, the preterists now say the little horn in Daniel 8 is Antiochus Epiphanes. They do not see this as the papacy or Rome. Here's where the deviation takes place, right here. Okay, so let's read. Let's read and go right into part 2, the interpretation. If you have your Bibles open to Daniel 8, please write down any questions you have and save them to the very end. Well, save them towards the end, because I'm sure there's going to be questions pretty soon. But I want to make sure that we cover the material. Sometimes the questions are better at the end. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And then, behold, there stood before me one with the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the river Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man, Daniel, understand the vision. So I came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, for the fulfillment of the vision belongs to the time of the end. Now, as he, my Bible says, Gabriel, was speaking with me, I fell stunned in a deep unconsciousness with my face to the ground, but he touched me and set me upright where I had stood. Verse 19, he said, behold, I will make you know what will be in the latter times of the indignation, for it has to do with the time of the end. The ram which you saw having two horns, which are the kings of Media and Persia, or not which, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the shaggy rough he-goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eye is the first king, my Bible says, who consolidated the whole realm, and his name was Alexander the Great. Verse 22, and as for the horn which was shattered, in whose place four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise out of his nation, but not having his power. Alexander's power. Verse 23. And the latter end of the kingdom, when the transgressors, the apostate Jews, have reached the fullness of their wickedness, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark trickery and craftiness shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall corrupt and destroy astonishingly, and shall prosper and do his own pleasure. And he shall corrupt and destroy the mighty men and the holy people. Verse 25, and through his policy he shall cause trickery to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart and mind, and in their security he will corrupt and destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken, and with that by no human hand. The vision of the evening mornings, which has been told you, is true. But seal up the vision, for it has to do with the distant future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick. I guess it says, for several days after I rose up and did the king's business, and I wondered at the vision, but there was no one who understood it or could make it understood. This is what I call, obviously, the interpretation part of the prophecy. And notice something very interesting happens here. The first question I have is, who is assigned to give Daniel understanding of the vision? The angel Gabriel. Write that down. Now, this is going to be crucial here. I want you to see this. Who assigned Gabriel this task? Who assigned Gabriel this task? Jesus. Put his name there. Now I want you to look at verse 13. Verse 13 says, and then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one that spoke, for how long is the vision concerning the continual or the daily and the transgression it makes desolate, and giving over both the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot? Now remember last week I told you this is incredible. There's angels there watching Daniel receive this vision. And suddenly one of the angels breaks out of the whole progress, interrupts the vision, turns his back on Daniel, and looks at the other person and says, how long is this going to go on? Read it very carefully and you'll see he was so startled that he turned to that other person. And it says a certain saint in the King James, which spoke. And if you look in the Hebrew, that word is palmane. You have it there in part A of number 2. Who assigned Gabriel this task? Jesus. A. Read verse 13. That certain palmane saint. Palmane is made up of two words, pile and mene. Pile means wonderful, and that happens to be Isaiah 9:6. What does Isaiah 9:6 say? Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders. And he shall be called Wonderful, Pele. Wonderful, Pele. The Hebrew word there is the first word in this compound word in verse 13. Wonderful. And then if you were to look at Daniel 5:25, you know that Daniel was called in by Belshazzar to interpret the handwriting on the wall. And the first word was meaning. And what does that word mean? Numbered. we have the wonderful numberer here. The person who is the wonderful numberer is the one that ordered Gabriel to give understanding to Daniel. Who is the wonderful numberer? Jesus. In fact, some Hebrews say it also means the wonderful, the numberer of secrets, because the word pele also means secret. They clearly see that this is a name of a very significant person. And as I showed you in Isaiah, that's the word called Jesus, the first one. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Wonderful. And those are all the terms referring to Jesus. We now discover in the prophecy of Daniel that Jesus shows up in person and he does not leave the book from this point on. He's the one that told Gabriel to give him the interpretation. And Gabriel's the highest angel in heaven. Who would you think would give him the orders? Right? The wonderful numberer, the numberer of secrets. The certain saint which spake was none other than Jesus Christ. Which means, folks, that Daniel 8:14, who spoke the words of Daniel 8:14? Unto 2300 evenings and mornings, and then the sanctuary will be cleansed. It was Jesus. Jesus is the one that spoke, because the angel turned and asked him the question. And Jesus gave him the answer. I can see Daniel standing there like this. He's watching the whole thing. And he fainted. And the angel went, wait a minute, hold on here. How long is this going to go on, Lord? And the Lord said, 2300 evenings and mornings, and then this thing is going to be turned around. The sanctuary will be cleansed. See, right here, this pivotal verse turns our understanding to the sanctuary, where we're introduced to Jesus as our high priest in the heavenly sanctuary. We clearly see the issues now here are the battle over his ministry and earthly ministry. And the majority of the world is being trained to the earth. The preterist, Antiochus Epiphanes, and the futurist, Jerusalem in the future. And they don't say anything about looking to Jesus. And the Seventh-day Adventists are holding this precious message, and we're even confused on the meanings. Partially because we're not studying for ourselves. Jesus is the one who commanded Gabriel to give this man understanding. Number four, what is the first thing Gabriel said to Daniel? He said it twice, verse 17 and 19. And why is this significant? At the time of the end shall be the vision, folks. Understand this. At the time of the end is not Antiochus Epiphanes. You got that? Hello? Anybody seen Antiochus lately? Have you? You don't even know who he is, do you? I'm going to introduce him to you. And you'll see how this doesn't make any sense at all. How can the majority of translators today believe Antiochus Epiphanes is the fulfillment of the little horn when the first thing out of Gabriel's mouth is that this 2300 evening and mornings extend to the time of the end? By the way, I better fill in some space here for you, because I come to think of it, you probably don't know yet the date of Antiochus Epiphanes, or just some of you do. So let's get to that. What's the significance? The first thing Gabriel told Daniel, was this is going to extend to the time of the end. We're talking about the last days here, Daniel. We're not talking about your day, okay? We're talking about beyond that. He says it twice, not once. Okay, so let's interpret the elements. What? It does do it three times. I skipped that. We're going to get to verse number 26, where he repeats that it's the distant future, the time of the end. That's true. 19. And in 19 twice. Yeah, and then he repeats it in 26. It's like, hello, everybody, I'm here. That was good that you helped me there. So notice that this is an important issue, and we're going to see shortly that that's one of the arguments against Antiochus Epiphanes possibly being a fulfillment of the little horn. Okay, the ram is who?
The kings
of Medo and Persia. The goat is who? The king of Greece. Write those in. That's number A and B. And of the goat, the large horn refers to Alexander the Great. Put it down. Now, when Alexander the Great died, by the way, at 33, the same age Jesus died. Okay? His kingdom was divided between his four generals. And Macedonia, which is the Grecian area, was given to a man, general named Cassandra. And Thrace in northwest Asia Minor was given to a man named Lysimachus. Now, Syria and Babylonia came under the Seleucids. Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the kings of the Seleucid dynasty. These were the general. Seleucus was the general assigned Syria and Babylonia, that part of Alexander's kingdom. And Ptolemy was given Egypt. So now you're starting to get the timing here of Antiochus Epiphanes. He was one of the Seleucid kings. By the way, let me do this for you. Go to page 5 quickly. And what do you see on page 5? How many U.S. presidents have we had? How many? 44. So we could put their pictures up, bing, 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 1 through 44, right? Okay, here's the Seleucid House of Leaders. From 1 down to the last one. Find Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes and circle his name. Find him on there. Do you find him yet? Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes. And he reigned from when? 175 and died in 164 B.C. Okay. When was Antiochus Epiphanes alive? Before Christ. Is that the time of the end, by the way? No, it isn't. I want you to circle that. This will become important for you. Take a look at that. Circle it now. Go back to page number 3. And at the very top it says, C, little horn, is it the papal Rome or is it Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes? Now, what I'm going to read to you now, I took out of my brand new NIV Archaeological Bible. And in it, in a section in Daniel, it gives this synopsis of Antiochus Epiphanes. Because that Bible says that Antiochus Epiphanes was the little horn of Daniel 8. Okay? Here's what it says. You got it. Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes ruled the Seleucid or Syrian kingdom from 175 to 164 B.C. Epiphanes means manifest, and the name indicates that he claims to be the earthly manifestation of who? Yes, notice he does not claim to be the earthly manifestation of Jesus. He claims to be the earthly manifestation of Zeus. Got that? Okay. Antiochus attempted to unify his empire by imposing Hellenistic culture on all his inhabitants. This policy brought him into sharp conflict with the Jews of the region of Palestine, most Bible scholars believe Antiochus IV to be the little horn of Daniel 8:9 and the contemptible person of Daniel 11:21. Notice this is the Bible, the archaeological Bible. I want you to see what their thinking is, folks, because I don't agree. Okay? In 171 B.C., however, oops, I skipped something, sorry. His relationship with the Jews are recorded in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, apocryphal books, and are prophetically depicted in Daniel 8, 9 through 12, 23 through 25, and Daniel 11, 21 through 34. He was infamous for establishing pagan worship in the temple in Jerusalem. Now, folks, I want you to look at this. Notice that most Bible scholars believe Antiochus Epiphanes to be the little horn. Notice that this Bible I'm taking this from says that you find that in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Now, here in my hands, we didn't establish this, did we, Jenny? I thought maybe this was my mother's Catholic Bible. I'm not sure. This book has more books in it, this Bible, than we have in ours. Why? There are certain books that the Catholic Church accepted as being inspired that was rejected long ago by the Jewish scholars who sat down and prayerfully decided what books should be considered in the Bible and what should be excluded. 1st and 2nd Maccabees was excluded from the Protestant Bible, and the Catholics added to theirs. Now, 1st and 2nd Maccabees is fairly good historically, but it is not an inspired book. And in it, it tells the story of Antiochus Epiphanes. It's very interesting. I brought it because I read it. Now, look. Now, I'm going to try to move through this systematically so it's understandable. So let's continue, and notice they clearly say that Antiochus Epiphanes is talked about in Daniel 8, 9 through 12, and we believe that to be the papal see. And Daniel 8, 23 through 25, and we believe that to be the papal see. And Daniel 11, 21 through 34, we believe that to be the papal see. Then it says he was infamous for establishing pagan worship in the temple in Jerusalem. Now, folks, pagan worship. See? This is important. He didn't claim to be Jesus. He claimed to be Zeus. He didn't claim that God has another way of worshiping now. He came and imposed a pagan way on the Jewish people. Okay, I'll give you some more of the stuff he did. In about 174 B.C., Jason, the leader of the pro-Greek faction in Jerusalem priesthood, bribed Antiochus to install him as high priest, after which Jason set about turning Jerusalem into a Greek city, 2 Maccabees 4, 7 through 21. He bribed Antiochus to be the high priest. He'd fit in real well with our society today. This is really good, you guys. Notice this. In 171 B.C., however, another man named Menelaus, in turn, bought the priesthood from Antiochus, and I actually, in Maccabees, he did it by offering 250 additional talents of silver more than Jason offered him. It says that in Maccabees. Okay? By the way, Jason had people executed, and Menelaus, before he was run out of Jerusalem by Jason, stole articles from the temple, gold articles, and it's recorded in Maccabees that he sold them for money in different cities like Tyre and Sidon. These are nice people. You can see why Jesus destroyed Jerusalem. It had gotten so corrupt, just like we are today. Jason, believing that Antiochus had died, seized Jerusalem by force. But Antiochus returned in 169 B.C. and carried out a massacre of the city of Jerusalem. See, he persecuted the saints. But Antiochus carried out a massacre. He then moved upon Egypt, but was humiliated by the Roman legate, C. Pompilius Laenus, and forced to make an undignified withdrawal to the north. Thereafter, this tyrant vigorously sought to Hellenize Jerusalem. In 164 B.C., Antiochus dispatched his tax collector Apollonius against Jerusalem with 22,000 men. They attacked on the Sabbath, killing most of the male population and enslaving the women and children. Jerusalem walls were demolished and the Seleucid military garrison stationed immediately south of the temple. All Jewish rites were outlawed, resulting in the cessation of the daily sacrifice. You see, they see this daily term meaning sacrifice, and so they go, oh, Antiochus Epiphanes stopped the daily sacrifice, so that's, therefore, he cast down the daily. See, but that's not what daily means. See, I see some of you shaking your head, which is very encouraging to me. When I see some going, ah, I got it, I understand. Very encouraging to me. Okay. An altar to Zeus was erected over the Jewish altar, a burnt offering, and worship of Zeus was instituted in the temple. On December 25th, 167 B.C., a pig was sacrificed on the Zeus altar. This was the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of in Daniel 9:23, Daniel 11:31, and Daniel 12:11. 9:27. I don't know what I said. I meant 9:27. Okay, now let me tell you something. Now, 1 Maccabees 1:54 implies the phrase desolating sacrilege of Daniel 9:27 to what Antiochus Epiphanes did to the altar in Jerusalem. By the way, this parenthesis means I put this here. And then I put what? See Matthew 24, verse 15. Why? Let's go to Matthew 24, verse 15. Did you think of something, John? Huh? Yes. Yep. Now notice what Jesus said. Jesus said, so when you see the appalling sacrilege, comma, the abomination that astounds and makes desolate, spoken by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader take notice. What is Jesus telling us here? Hasn't happened yet. Hasn't happened. It turns out that the apocryphal book in the Catholic Bible claims that that was the sacrilege that causes desolation. Therefore, they look at, he did away with the daily sacrifice and he set up the abomination that causes desolation by sacrificing a pig. But Jesus said, no, when you see it happen, it hasn't happened yet. Because Antiochus Epiphanes is not the little horn of Daniel 8. So I put that in there. And notice, we're going against that, this big, beautiful Bible that these translators all believe. It's Antiochus Epiphanes. Yeah. That's a good idea, John. I'll write him a letter. Okay, so notice what happened now. Enraged, the Jews rebelled against their Greek overlords and under Judas Maccabeus defeated the armies of Antiochus that he had sent against them. After a 3-year struggle, Jewish forces gained major concession from the Greeks and the Maccabees became de facto rulers of Judea, Most notably, they purified the temple and reinstated the daily sacrifice. Notice I put exactly 3 years and 10 days after Antiochus set up the altar to Zeus in the temple, and by the way, sacrificed the pig. An event commemorating this purification is called what? Hanukkah. Antiochus himself, who had moved off to the east to campaign in Elam, died in Persia in 164 BC. Now, friends, I took this out of that Bible to show you that these translators believe that Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn. But I want to show you a couple things as you look at this. First of all, they tell you that some of this information is obtained from an apocryphal book. Number two, they tell you he was humiliated by the Roman legate, C. Pompilius Linus. Did you know the story? Did you ever hear the story of drawing a line in the sand? Do you know where that came from? You don't know that one? I thought you did. Okay, Antiochus Epiphanes came to Egypt to attack it, I think in 168, and he took the delta. The delta area became his. And by the way, notice he was fighting against one of his own ex-generals, Ptolemy. Ptolemy was also a Greek king. They were fighting back and forth constantly. We'll see that reflected in Daniel 11. They were fighting back, king of the north, king of the south, fighting each other. Then he came back the next year to take Alexandria, which was the capital city. When he arrived there with his soldiers, the Roman legate walked out and right up to him, drew a circle around him and said, "The Roman Senate voted that you will leave now." And guess what Antiochus did? That's why it says humiliated. And then if you'll notice, he couldn't even keep his hands in control of Palestine. They overthrew his control. And then he went to the east to try to fight and win back some of his father's property that he had won towards India. And he failed there, which I'll show you shortly, and then died in that campaign. This is very important because if you notice, it says that this little horn exceedingly... I'm jumping ahead. What was the term? Waxed exceedingly great to the east and to the south and to the beautiful land. And I just showed you from the writing, from the Bible, that accepts Antiochus shows you that he was kicked out of Egypt, he lost control of Jerusalem, and then when he went to east to try to win back some of the property that his father had previously conquered, he died. Before he died, he failed, though, by the way. Okay, so I'm giving you the history here. You got it? So we're showing you that this is really a battle between Jesus Christ and Satan, who has his cohorts on earth that are battling against Christ's ministry. It's not talking about some heathen who doesn't even believe the way we do, who are trying to, you know, even though he did hideous things in Jerusalem. The point is, it isn't the little horn. How do I know? Argument number one against Antiochus Epiphanes being the little horn of Daniel 8. Number one, Antiochus IV was one king of the Seleucid dynasty. The little horn should represent a kingdom, not an individual king. Do you hear me? Do you got that? Okay, look at the Bible proofs. Verse 22, the four horns represented four different kingdoms. Am I correct? Okay. Verse 20, the two horns represented, the Persian ram represented the kings of Media and Persia. Chapter 7, the little horn represented the papal see. Verse 7:17, the four beasts represented what? Four kingdoms. In Daniel 2:38 and 39, it's the angel, or Daniel said, "King Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold, and after you will come a what? Another kingdom." It's essential that you clearly see this simple, logical argument that Antiochus was one king of a kingdom. And if we allow him to be the interpretation, we're breaking the rules of hermeneutical principles, how to interpret the Bible prophecy properly. Do you got that? I hope you see that. Okay? Just in case you need to look, go back to 5 and look at that and see that he was one king of all this kingdom here, and all the other horns and beasts represented kingdoms, not a particular king. That's number one. Okay, argument number two against Antiochus Epiphany being the little horn of Daniel 8. Verse 9, he grew exceedingly towards the south, towards the east, towards the beautiful land. I already told you about this, didn't I? What does it say towards the south? Antiochus attempted to add Egypt to his conquest. He succeeded in the Delta area in 169 BC. But the following year he came back to march on Alexandria and was turned back by the Roman legate, C. Papilius Linnaeus, merely informing him the Roman Senate wanted him to leave. So he left and lost all his previous holdings in Egypt. Did he wax great to the south? No, he didn't. He waxed exceedingly great to the east. Antiochus' father, Antiochus III, by the way, his father was called Antiochus the Great. And it turns out that his father is the one that actually took all the territory Antiochus got to be part of, except for Egypt. Okay? So he waxed exceedingly for the east. Listen to this. Antiochus III conquered all the way to India in 210 to 206 BC. After his departure, much of the territory was lost because of rebellion. The last 2 years of his reign, Antiochus attempted to win back the territory. In 164/3 BC, after military successes in Armenia and Media, he was unable to defeat the Parthians and died during the final that failed campaign. Did he wax exceedingly great towards the east? No, he didn't. Did he wax exceedingly great towards the beautiful land? Antiochus did not conquer Palestine. His father, Antiochus III, did. In fact, although Antiochus did persecute the Jews, shut down the sanctuary service, his army suffered repeated defeats at the hand of the Jewish Maccabean forces, which led ultimately to Palestinian independence. Did he wax exceedingly great towards the beautiful land? He did not. He did not. Number three, Antiochus Epiphanes being the horn. Verse 17, 19, 26. Understand that the vision pertains to when? The time of the end. And here's what I put. Antiochus IV appeared nowhere near the time of the end. I'm sorry. Nowhere near. We have to come to grips with that. Okay, argument number what? Four, against Antiochus being... Oh, I forgot the word against all those times, didn't I? In number four, against Antiochus, I left that word out. Okay, notice it says, out of one of them came forth a rather small horn. Okay, folks, another reason they say Antiochus Epiphanes is because they say... I better do this with you. Take your Bibles and notice verse 10. Oh, no. Verse 8 and 9. Okay. Daniel 8. We're still in Daniel 8. Thank you, Larry. This one may throw you a little bit, and it may not. We'll have fun with it, but... You already know three of the neat arguments. I mean, it's incredible when you look at it. We got to be consistent in our interpretation, folks. We can't be hopping around, especially according to current events or whatever. We got to stay consistent. The Bible interprets itself. It repeats itself over and over again. It enlarges every time it repeats. And if we're going to make horns and beasts kingdoms, then we can't all of a sudden make a horn a person. And remember, the little horn is not the Pope. The little horn is the papal see, the system, represented by a whole bunch of popes. Okay, let's give this a shot. Verse 8. And the he-goat magnified himself exceedingly, and when he was strong, was suddenly broken. And instead of him, there came up four notable horns towards the four winds of heaven. And then your King James says, and out of one of them, right? And so they go, okay, out of one of them means out of one of those four horns. Well, if it came out of one of those four horns, then Antiochus could easily be the interpretation because he came from one of those four horns. But is there agreement between the number and gender of horn and the number and gender of them? Because in Hebrew, the pronoun has to agree in number and gender with the noun. Now, you all know from English that the noun and verb have to agree in number, correct? That if the noun is plural, the verb has to be plural. If the noun is singular, the verb. But in Hebrew, they add also feminine, masculine, or neuter. Now, watch this. Okay. Did the little horn originate out of one of the horns, or did he originate out of one of the four winds? Nouns in Hebrews have grammatical gender, masculine, feminine, neuter. Pronouns must agree in gender. I forgot to put number, by the way. You can add that. And number, too. With their antecedent noun. Horns is always feminine. Winds can be either masculine or feminine. The pronoun them is masculine. This means that the antecedent noun for them cannot be horns. It has to be winds. Has to be. So out of one of those winds. And by the way, if you go back to Daniel 7, it says the wind was blowing on the great sea and out of it came four beasts, right? So the first wind blew the first king. The second wind blew the third. And how would you call it? What's it called? Notice how we reconcile by looking at the gender and number here that it only makes sense that the little horn also comes from a wind. Not from a horn. But notice what Dr. Bill Shea says. I thought this was really interesting. I'm going to give you another one. This was Mervyn Maxwell and a couple other people who see this. Horns is always feminine. I understand that. But winds can either be masculine or feminine. Therefore, them could only refer to winds. But notice what he found. And remember, he was Dr. Bill Shea. He was an MD who went back to study Near Eastern Studies and got his PhD. He was my favorite seminary professor. The English translation out of one of them obscures the actual Hebrew construction of the first part of verse 9 because it begins with two prepositional phrases and should be translated from one from them. So now look, verse 8, to the four winds, which is feminine, of heaven, heavens, which is masculine, from one, which is feminine, of them, which is masculine. So by showing that the construct of the very first phrase, two prepositional phrases in verse 9, beautifully brings together the gender and the number, showing clearly that the word them is talking about winds, not about horns. So it cannot be Antiochus Epiphanes because the little horn came out of one of the winds, not out of one of the four horns. Okay? All right, you deal with that. I can see there's like a... It can be seen that the gender of the first two elements of verse 9, one and them, line up perfectly with the gender of the last two elements at the end of verse 8, winds and heaven. Okay. Thus, the little horn did not come from one of the four horns, but rather from one of the four winds. Therefore, the little horn could not be Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I want you to couple that with this next argument, number five. Argument number five against Antiochus being the little horn. In verse 23, it says, and in the latter period of their rule. Okay, if you check verse 23, it had just finished talking about the four horns. And then it says, towards the latter period of their rule, this little horn came into being. At the latter end of the four horns of the four kingdoms that took over from Alexander the Great, the little horn would come out at the end. Now look at Antiochus Epiphanes on your chart. Did you circle Antiochus the fourth Epiphanes? Where would you say he comes in that chart? At the beginning, in the middle, or the end? Middle? I agree with you. Therefore, how can it possibly say in the latter period of their rule? Not only that, in the Hebrew, it's really plain. That latter means more than just towards the end. It really implies when they were finished. This is, when you put these last two arguments together, you see clearly that trying to plug in Antiochus Epiphanes breaks all the rules of interpretation. Can't do it. And yet, folks, the majority of translators believe the little horn is who? Antiochus Epiphanes. Yeah. So why do we labor so much on this? Because I want to show you that we have a leg to stand on. And they don't. Number six, against Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 23 through 25, description of the little horn in these verses clearly depict the action and the work of the Roman Empire and its successor, the Roman Church, papacy. See chapter 7, those verses, not Antiochus Epiphanes. Folks, when you look at spoke words against the Most High, where is that ever referred to? Yes, he persecuted the Jews, okay? He did do that. Yes, he set up the thing in the altar of Zeus. He did do that. Not the time of the end. And this is a kingdom, not an individual king of the kingdom. We're talking about somebody who attacked Jesus, not who just exerted their pagan beliefs on a group of Christians. We're talking about a Christian who exerts his beliefs to deceive the Christians in such a way that the majority agree with him and then decides to kill those who goes against his teaching. See that? Now, when you read about this, he waxed great. He waxed even to the host of heaven. Antiochus was kicked out of Egypt, was defeated by Judas Maccabeus and his group, and then went off to the east and couldn't beat the Parthenons and died. Come on. He was just one tragic figure in history that has now been used to divert the attention of God's people away from Jesus Christ and the truth. Argument number seven, against Antiochus being the little horn. By the way, folks, please write the word against in there for me. I don't know how I missed that word, but I don't want anybody to find your thing laying around and they come up with the alternate idea from what I am implying here. He shall also stand up to the Prince of Princes. Antiochus the Fourth that did persecute the Jews, set up the altars, Zeus in the temple, sacrificed the pig on the altar, shut down the sanctuary, sir, stopped the daily sacrifice, but did not stand up against the Prince of Princes. He was a known pagan idol worshiper. He made himself Zeus and not Jesus. Also, he did not set himself up in the place as a priestly ministry. Do you got that? See, we're talking about replacement here, not just attacking. The little horn replaces Jesus. Antiochus never did that. He never attempted to to substitute his ministry, priestly ministry, in the praise of Jesus. He just set up his pagan worship and tried to force the people to be like Greeks. And by the way, he got it for doing that too, didn't he? They kicked him right out of there. Argument number 8 against Antiochus, the 2300 evening mornings. I love this. I hope you get this one. The pagan idol was set up on the altar of burnt offering on the 15th day of the 9th month of the 145th year of the Seleucid reign. The pagan sacrifice began 10 days later, 1 Maccabees 1, 54 and 59. On the 25th day of the 9th month of the 148th year of the Seleucid era, the newly built altar was consecrated and celebration continued for 8, I guess that's days thereafter, 1 Maccabees 4, 52 and 54. Thus, for 3 years, or 3 years and 10 days, whichever way you want to see it, was involved here. When he set up his temple, or his altar to Zeus, 10 days later sacrificed the pig, 3 years later exactly, his forces were defeated, and they purified the temple and reinstituted the services. Now notice this. Thus, the 3 years, or 3 years and 10 days, was involved here. Neither 2,300 literal days, which is 6 years, 4 months, and 2/3 months, nor 1,150 literal days, fits this historical period, since even the shorter of the two is 2 months too long. Now, what am I saying? In order to support the belief that Antiochus Epiphanes is the fulfillment, they say the 2,300 days are not literal days, but they're sacrifices, one in the morning, one in the evening. So it's talking about 1,150 literal days. Now, first of all, when the sacrifice is referred to, it's always called the morning and evening sacrifice. It is never called the evening and the morning. Secondly, in Genesis, the day was called the evening was and the morning was. Here, when Jesus spoke 2,300 days, he said evening, mornings, exactly like Genesis, which means they were literal days. In order to make Antiochus fit, they disregard the hermeneutical principle. If it's days in Genesis, it has to be days here. And they said instead it's half days. So they divide 2,300 days. They come up with 1,150 because it's closer to fitting Antiochus Epiphanes, only it's 2 months too long. Whoops. First of all, they have no business or no hermeneutical right. There's nowhere in the Bible that supports them dividing it in half to start with. But they end up reverting to that because they can't get out of the argument. So they come up with this idea because 2,300 days is way too long for Antiochus Epiphanes. We're talking about 3 years. So they divide it in half. Folks, do you see we're trying to put a round peg in a square hole? And do you see why Satan is supporting this? He wants Jesus' ministry cast to the ground. He'll throw in with the futurists that are in the future. He'll throw in with the predecessors that are in the past. And he loves it when Antiochus Epiphanes is to believe to be the fulfillment, because it takes the eyes off of Jesus Christ and the organization that Satan is using in concert with the false prophet and with spiritualism to, in the last days, deceive those who keep the commandments of God. Brothers and sisters, we can be so thankful that we are privileged to not be as confused as others on these prophecies because they don't use hermeneutical principles to interpret. They use whatever fits their thinking. And when we see that beginning to pick away on the edges of Adventism, be warned, folks, that you need to read your Old Testament and see that Jerusalem constantly fell in the trap of being like the world around them. That is happening. So, I'm not even sure there aren't more arguments than just 8, but I gave you 8. Paper's expensive today. Evening and mornings is a phrase that's used to describe a 24-hour period during creation. This phrase is never used to describe the daily sacrifice. It's always referred to, the daily sacrifice is always referred to as morning and evening sacrifice. The phrase 2300 evening and mornings has nothing to do with Antiochus Epiphanes. And by the way, the sanctuary will be cleansed. See, they say that in Hanukkah, after 3 years, they cleansed it. But if you notice, some of this, some of their impetus comes out of an apocryphal book called 1st and 2nd Maccabees that was rejected by the church as being canonical or inspired. So that's it. Now let's look at the last two verses, but notice I was exhausted when I finished this as I am right now. He said, the vision of the evening and mornings which you have been told is true. But seal up the vision, for it has to do and belong to the now distant future. By the way, that should have been argument number 9, shouldn't it? Why? The vision was sealed till when? What did he tell Daniel in Daniel 12? Twice. Seal up the vision, for it's till the time of the end. It isn't for right now. It's for the time of the end. Now, the Jews may have found some comfort in these words when they were going through this experience, but I'll tell you something. This isn't the time of the end, folks. And I would really like you to read some of the history, even Maccabees, and see how spiritual those people were back then. It is really a sad circumstances that what was going on there. Why were they in captivity in the first place? They weren't faithful. By the way, the father of Hezekiah, Ahaz, went to visit the king of Assyria, saw his pagan altar, sent to his high priest in Jerusalem a copy, and said, make this. From now on, I want a sacrifice on it just that way. King Ahaz. Read it in your Bible. So setting up an altar to Zeus is not fooling anybody, folks, because we all know that's pagan. But when you set up an altar that claims to be Christian and claims to take the place of Christ, then this is dangerous. And that's what's going on. Okay, any questions? I covered everything. Oh, who knows where Ahaz is? 1st, 2nd Kings, just before 2nd Kings. When I found that, I thought that was pretty insightful. Take a look at 2 Kings 16 so far. Let me find the verse. Take a look at 2 Kings. Is it 17? Of 16 or 17? 16. You know, I'm looking right at it, and I'm at this point, I'm like, okay, here it is. King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw there their heathen altar. King Ahaz sent to Urijah, the priest, a model of the altar and the exact pattern for its construction. So Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus, finishing it before King Ahaz returned. When the king came from Damascus, he looked at the altar and offered on it. King Ahaz burnt his burnt offerings and his cereal offerings and poured his drink offerings and dashed blood of the meat offerings upon that altar. The bronze altar which was before the Lord was removed from the front of the house from between his new altar and the house of the Lord and put in the north side of his altar. And King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, upon the principle, the new altar, burn the morning burnt offering and the evening cereal offering. Folks, I want to tell you something. This is more abominable than what Antiochus did. Why? Because Ahaz knew better. He was, quote unquote, one of God's people. Folks, do you see how foolish we look when we try to be like the world instead of like the remnant? So if you think, if God was to condemn somebody, he wouldn't condemn Antiochus. He would condemn Ahaz. Why? Because Ahaz was the king of Judah. So there you have it. I'll tell you, it's well worth it. I did it, and I'm going to go back to it. Read 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. It'll appall you at how far they fell. Folks, if they did it back then, we're doing it now. And so it's warning us what to be careful of, you see? And imagine you could go so far. I mean, the priest did exactly what the king said. Where's the priest that say, I beg your pardon, king? Kill me, but I'm not going to do it. This is God's house. He designed the altar.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.